Welcome to the Command Line Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. Here I am again a week later. I've got some more news for my reading that I want to talk about. I don't know if I'll be able to keep up a weekly pace, but I'm going to give it a try and we'll see how this all works out over the next couple of weeks. First, I want to thank Florian, who sent some nice feedback on Twitter, just saying that he liked the new format, doesn't think it has to be extensive coverage of everything tech-related happening, and that definitely mirrors a sentiment that's come up several times as I've talked about in the last handful of months, how to really find a way to get on the mic more consistently, whether that be sharing essays, or in this instance, post the decision to bring the newscast back. The first story I wanted to talk about, actually, again, not really so much a story, maybe more on the programming side, and something very near and dear to my heart. If you read the website at all, you may have remembered a piece called Fear and Hope in the World of Vim, and this is about my decision to go back to an old power editor that's been around in the world of Linux and Unix-like operating systems for some time. This post, just called A Good Vim RC, it's a couple of things. This is posted on dougblack.io. I presume that's Doug Black's personal blog. And while it has the usual sort of things that you expect in the world of Vim users, all these kinds of recommendations on how to set up your text editor. That's what the VimRC refers to, is it's just the configuration file where you turn different options on and off and customize things to suit your particular style of writing or coding or both. There's plenty of that in this and plenty of stuff to dig through if you're a Vim user like myself or you're considering taking the plunge. But he starts off with this simple notion and he calls it out in a really clear block quote right at the top that just says, don't put any lines in your VimRC that you don't understand. What he means by that is don't just copy and paste tips and tricks that you find from around the web. Take some time. Read through the help files. Understand your tool, understand what's being recommended, and then only add it once you have some understanding of how this changes your environment. I think this is actually really good broad general advice in the world of programming, is don't adopt things until you've had a chance to really kind of grapple with them and understand them. Certainly don't turn around and recommend them to other folks. I see that from time to time. People fall in love with a particular framework, tool, or technique, and they immediately start evangelizing it. When you ask a few questions, I think it becomes evident that they don't really quite understand what it is that they're proposing. So I think this is a good advice and a good philosophy to live by, even if it's here in the context of something very specific. I think it's thoughtful and I like it. It's just something that stuck with me during the course of this week. Oh, and if you're curious, you can see my VimRC file on GitHub. I'll drop a link to that in amongst the other links in the show notes. And hopefully I've exhibited this advice very clearly that everything is commented and hopefully clear. And you're always welcome to submit an issue or a pull request against it if I haven't made something clear or haven't lived up to this advice in my own practice. Ada Lovelace Day was this past week. This is a day that's been set aside by folks interested in encouraging more women to take part in the world of science, technology, engineering, and math. I found a piece on Wired, not my first place to go for Ada Lovelace Day stories, but it was a good piece as it turns out. It's a profile of Margaret Hamilton. She was one of the programmers involved in the Apollo program. Now, there are aspects of this I still find troubling in terms of just a reminder of the time and place where she did her work, that things were laughed off that I think we as a society hopefully are growing to understand are not the kinds of things that you should laugh off. They're not the kinds of things that we should support in a culture. We should be more thoughtful and deliberate. That being said, for her to do what she did, to contribute in the ways that are described in this article, given that environment, is just astonishing. And her contribution is not inconsiderable. There's a photo, I don't know if it's in this Wired article, I've certainly seen it elsewhere, of the printouts of the code that she wrote for the program and physically printed out. It's as tall as she was at the time. There's another dimension to this article that I like even more. I think it's relevant if you yourself are a working programmer or you work in the world of tech already that hopefully you'll get. And it's the fact that there's an incident that they relate, an anecdote, where the powers that be in NASA basically laughed off something that she found experimentally. Maybe that's putting it a little strong, but basically expressed that sentiment that I think too many of us are still familiar with of that will never happen. We don't have to deal with that. It's just not worth the cost. Now, of course, on Apollo 8, what happened? Exactly what she discovered in working with the program code for the control systems did happen. And I think it's really cool to see that her work, that anecdote, that moment in particular, contributed to a sea shift that we're still seeing unfolding in modern programming of people taking quality seriously, and not just taking quality seriously, but the ways that they approach it, you know, simulating and testing, working through permutations, and not accepting this notion of that will never happen. Having perhaps, hopefully, maybe I'm being naively optimistic here, more a sense of that probably won't ever happen, but just in case, let's put some safeguards in to make sure that our program continues to work in the way that we intend and that it's more robust. Certainly when you're talking about moonshots or something that is in any way like flight control systems or other things that have impact on human life and safety, we should certainly be trying to embrace the lessons of Hamilton's work. This next story is from 18F. This is a group within the General Services Administration. And before you start snoring and nod off, I actually know some folks who've been involved with this program. It's an experimental program within the U.S. federal government to try to reform the way technology and process and procedures are pursued by bringing in an open source ethos. They do everything out in the open. They have all of their experiment code on GitHub. And anybody can review, contribute, pull requests, and work on as a consequence. But in this instance, what caught my eye is they're actually, it's a very specific thing that they're documenting. It's a bit of code to help make it easier to do what are called micro purchases in federal spending. No, wake up, please. Bear with me. This is something that I'm familiar with from my nonprofit days because we took in a lot of federal funding and the same sorts of rules and regulations applied. Now, here when we're talking about micro purchases, we're not talking about like the couple of dollars you might monthly spend on Patreon or send to a small project through PayPal. We're talking about things below a certain spending cap where you don't have the same sort of oversight and accountability rules, a little bit of flexibility at the lower end. Obviously, the more a federal program or federally funded entity outside of the government spends, the more accountability you want, and with good reason. Now, sometimes it overcompensates and it gets a little bureaucratic and it's crazy making, but you do want somebody asking good hard questions about, you know, how large things are spent so you don't end up with an $18,000 hammer or toilet seat or any number of the other anecdotes or jokes that we've all heard about U.S. federal spending. Now here, though, to be able to do some small spending and have some creative flexibility, what they're playing around with in particular are for contractors and services. So this is pretty cool. I encourage you to take a look through it. They've got some screenshots and a pretty good description of what they're doing. And I think a healthy dose of realism about how this might turn out, that this might actually work as intended, but they're open to learning from it regardless. And I think that seems to animate the spirit of 18F. Part of the reason I'm sharing this too is that a friend of mine and a longtime listener sent me another link, which I'll drop in the show notes, that actually tells how 18F got its start and how it compares against another similar effort in the U.S. government called the U.S. Digital Service. Both worth checking out. Couple of quick stories that I wanted to share following up on themes that I always like to follow very closely. The first in the space of copyright is a story of Aorus. This is, if you're familiar with Popcorn Time, which is a service to help find video that you might be interested in that may not come from legitimate places, and it's come under fire for being a tool that aids piracy. Well, Aorus seems to be the same sort of thing. It itself doesn't host any illegitimate copyright infringing content, but it does seem to be helpful in finding online streams that, again, may not be things that you've paid for and necessarily have a legitimate license to access. It is drawing fire in the form of a lawsuit from the rights holders, the Recording Industry Association of America. Geez, how do I say RIAA? Don't always think about what that expands out to. Now, regardless of what you think of the legality or the ethics involved with artists as a service, and I think that there are some good substantial questions I'm not going to dig into right now. What's worrying about this is the contours of the lawsuit, and there's another link that I'll share from Mike Masnick, one of my favorites over at TechDirt, actually the founder of TechDirt, digging into how the recording industry here is behaving as if a law that activists and protesters shot down, SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, is actually in effect. So they're not going just directly after the author or the service and under an inducement to infringe, which is technically illegal with the laws on the books that we have here in the U.S. They're actually going after third parties too, and that was a very troublesome aspect of SOPA. And if we have a court rule in favor of industry, that could have very chilling consequences on down the line. So this is worth tracking. The Verge piece is pretty good in the particulars, but definitely if you only read two of the links that I'm providing here, read the one from Mike over at TechDirt. It asks the right kinds of questions, the kinds of things that we should be paying attention to as this unfolds. And on that basis, I expect I'll be talking about this more as the lawsuit progresses, or hopefully, in the best possible case, doesn't. The other story I wanted to talk about very quickly was some research published at an ACM event by Alex Halderman and Nadia Henninger, and they shared this on Freedom to Tinker, one of my favorite blogs for research, especially in the computer security space. And here, they set out to suggest how it is that the NSA may actually, in practice, be breaking so much crypto. And the answer is that there are some assumptions of how people interpret the math that underlies modern cryptography that implementers, programmers like me, make, maybe for the sake of simplicity, maybe out of ignorance. Regardless, the point that they make, and I think it's worth reading the Freedom to Tinker piece itself, is because they explain this in a very readable, understandable, accessible fashion. The point is, the NSA only has to break certain large primes, because those are used over and over and over again, apparently. And there's some very disturbing math here in terms of how much advantage the NSA or really any attacker would get from breaking any one of these primes, let alone going the extra effort to break two or more. The good news is that this particular attack that this research lays out is intensely expensive. The bad news is what we've learned from the Snowden leaks around the NSA's surveillance efforts is that their budget is well encompassing of the cost of breaking several of these primes that are primitive critical components of the things, the software that keeps everything that we do online safe. So it's very feasible. This theory is very, very feasible, and there are things laid out in the research that are highly suggestive. There's no smoking gun. This is not saying this is how the NSA is breaking SSL, is breaking encryption on people's communications on the web and online, but it's very, very possible. It's very probable, in fact, and this has been making the rounds quite a bit as a consequence. The silver lining, of course, is that while the NSA can afford to do that, which is scary in and of itself enough, it means that your average criminal, not so much. They're not going to have the multiple billion dollar budget to cover the computing resources to do this. So that's some consolation, but not a lot, because what you have to think about here, what we've definitely seen over the last handful of months with the OPM hack, is that just because the NSA got it as part of the U.S. federal government, doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to keep it secure. Or even if they keep it secure, the pressure for them to share with other agencies within the Fed, with other law enforcers, means that the attack surface, the likelihood of that leaking beyond them getting it from a secure channel through this very expensive but very plausible attack, that goes up considerably. Now, there's another article to give you a little bit more hope that I'm going to include. This is from the Deep Links blog EFF. Not surprisingly, gives some very practical advice on reducing the risk of your communications online being exposed to this likely form of attack. One last thing I want to share before I go is that longtime listener, Kevin, has been working for pretty much as long as he's reached out to me to let me know that he's been listening and he enjoys the work that I do. He's been working on a documentary project. This is called Trans Geek the Movie, and it's, I think, a very valuable effort to open up spaces that maybe are not as comfortable or as readily talking about as we should, especially in the world of tech and geek culture, where we have people dealing with gender identity questions and trying to process those in a safe and healthy way. He has just started a Kickstarter with his collaborators on the movie, which to me communicates that they're at a critical stage to get this out into the world, to share this with everybody. I've watched the pitch video. I really like the approach here. I have to say, of these kinds of projects that deal with these heavy issues, these very thoughtful, intensive issues, he's doing it much more with the community that this is focusing in on rather than on behalf of. And I think that's fantastic. I encourage you to, at a minimum, check out the Kickstarter for the pitch video and see if you agree with me on that assessment. If you do, just help me signal boost, help them reach their funding goal. At the time that I'm recording and releasing this episode, they've got most of the month left. They've just started the Kickstarter. Now, beyond that, if you have experience with these issues, as I know many of us have in this space, I've had conversations with many of my listeners, many of my close friends, people that I've worked with in jobs past and present have had to deal with these kinds of issues. I really encourage you to think about also stepping up as a backer, putting in a pledge, and helping them get this out into the world, because I think it's very worthy. And as I said, I really like the approach being taken here. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to record a bit of audio with your smart device and send it to the same place. Until next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.